welcome to this Tuesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up on the show in just a bit, the scholar who transformed North Dakota wheat. In his weekly Plainsfolk essay, historian Dr. Tom Easern profiles Lawrence R. Waldron, a pioneering agricultural scientist. And when fixed incomes can't cover the grocery bill, we hear as food prices rise, millions of older Americans are now struggling to afford nutritious meals. And we begin Main Street today with a North Dakota perspective of President Trump's recent tariffs that have renewed tensions between the United States and Canada. President Trump is moving forward with new tariffs on Canadian goods after trade negotiations between the two countries broke down. And today, Canada retaliated with tariffs on hundreds of American products, raising economic and political questions for North Dakota, where Canada is the state's largest international trading partner. Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane is the Loman Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University and senior historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. His work focuses on international relations, presidential history, and American political culture, and he joins us periodically here on Main Street. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again, Craig.
So much to talk about today. Let's begin with the current situation. What happened during final negotiations between the Trump administration and the Canadian trade negotiators? And what tariffs are now planned to take effect? And then we'll get into the significance of all of this.
Yeah, it looks like things sort of broke down on Friday between the negotiators. And there had been signs that things were going well, actually. In fact, Trump had extended the negotiations for a few more days, and it looked like things were moving in the right direction until there were sort of red lines being crossed on a couple of issues. Some people might think that the issues were around lumber and alcohol because those have been in the news so much. But actually, the three areas in which things broke down was over streaming. So this was an issue that the United States wanted there to be a non-Canadian prioritized content on, like Netflix, right? So when you tune into Netflix in Canada, you see Canadian content there. Well, the United States wanted that to be, you know, delisted or at least not prioritized. And that, of course, is a cultural red flag for the Canadians. The other two big issues that proved insurmountable was that the U.S. wanted an end to what we might call the Buy Canadian project, which was actually created when the first round of tariffs were announced. Mark Carney said, you know, we want to promote Canadian products and the U.S. wants that scrapped. But that seems really strange. I mean, imagine telling Americans that you can't have the Made in the USA label out there as a marketing product. The other one is really interesting, too. And this is the one that I think for Mark Carney is about identity and sovereignty. The U.S. negotiators wanted Canada to adopt U.S. trade policies. So what I mean by that is that if Canada negotiated with Brazil on a trade deal, then if it went against American policy, the United States wanted Canada to scrap that. And that was really like asking Canada to give up its sovereignty and not be an independent country when it comes to trade policy. And that was where I think Carney drew the line.
It certainly seems to be about sovereignty. What does the Trump administration, Michael, hope to accomplish with this posture?
I mean, I think the Trump administration in the United States is aiming to push Canadian products out of the American market. I mean, lumber, aluminum, steel, those sort of things are very competitive. The only thing that the United States is like worried about, you know, Canada not sending down south is oil, in which actually Carney has come out and said that oil is still going to flow into the United States. I mean, if Carney had turned around and said, we're going to put export tariffs on oil, that would be really detrimental to the global economy and not just the United States and Canada. But I think what the United States wants is American-made automobiles, American-made aluminum and steel, and American-made lumber to be more competitive. And actually, the truth is, if they don't have tariffs on Canadian products, the Canadian products are cheaper and more likely to sell.
I should note Canadians export electricity also to some parts of the United States, including northern North Dakota. Why escalate the dispute now? How much of timing is economic? How much of it is political?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both economic and political. I mean, I think the big thing is here is that there's going to be pain on both sides from this. You know, we're talking about North Dakota, but the pain on the Canadian side over the border is also going to be there as well economically. So the reason I think at the moment why this has happened is because the trust is gone. Mark Carney is exceedingly popular in Canada. Polling suggests that over 70, maybe 75% of Canadians agree with this policy. So in part, Carney is backed by a super majority of Canadians. And so because the trust is gone, because he has the political support at home, Carney can do this. I mean, he's unlike just about any other foreign world leader right now who is taking on Trump over tariffs. Most other places like the European Union, Vietnam, China have negotiated settlements with Trump. And Carney is not doing that because he's got the public opinion behind him.
It's interesting to me where these tariffs fit. Our conflict with the U.S.-Mexico-Canadian agreement that was negotiated by President Trump in his first term. We all remember NAFTA, and the president did not like that at all. So this new tariff policy came into place, and now he has trouble with it. What's changed?
I mean, nothing has changed, really. I mean, this is the amazing thing about business and trade, is that it's like a flowing river of water. If you put a dam up, the water just gets diverted to the next most navigable path. And that's what's happened. I mean, so with NAFTA, we had an agreement that saw the auto industry move south to Mexico. We saw the lumber industry grow in Canada. And then when the USMCA agreement was signed in Trump's first term, we saw all of these countries and the industries that work in those countries adjust. And it hasn't adjusted in the favor of the United States. There's been no great growth in manufacturing. There's been some small wins that Trump can definitely claim came out of this trade agreement. But on the whole, the lumber industry in Canada is still undercutting American prices, as is the aluminum and steel industry and the auto industry. And in Mexico, it's the same as well. There's small goods manufacturers in Mexico that are still cheaper. And so I think that's why Trump is saying we have to renegotiate this again. But the truth is that the same is likely to happen, that river is just going to change course again, find the easiest path with less resistance, and then we're going to have to renegotiate again. So this is a constant battle. It would be much more stable if the United States, Canada, and Mexico could just choose a lane to stick in, and then we could have profitable trade between those countries, with some countries being strong in some industries and other countries, you know, being, but not, the United States won't be strong in all of them. That's very unlikely.
The auto industry has been in the news relative to these tariffs. It's guessed that the president wants to put the brakes on any Canadian auto play. What are your thoughts about that, in what the auto industry can look like, and if Canada isn't a player, what's that going to mean for the United States?
Well, and I'd lump Mexico in here as well, too, because to create a car in the United States, which so many producers do for the final product, requires parts from other countries that are manufactured in other countries, whether it's Canada, Mexico, or whether it's further afield. And so, you know, this is not a supply chain that is, you know, completely made in the USA. Even if it's a Ford or a Chevy, which has got, you know, everything American about those cars, right? You know, the radio might be made in Mexico, the antennas might be made in Canada. And consequently, we need to think about the consumer, the final, you know, if you're putting a tariff of 50% on that antenna, how much does that jack up the price of the final product? And I think the consumers know that, because the consumers, when they go to the dealership, they're going to see the prices are higher for the final product. And they're frustrated. I mean, Americans on the whole right now are frustrated with inflation. It hasn't gone down as quickly as it was promised. And the economy, as a consequence, has suffered. And we have this sort of what they're calling the K economy. The people that can afford the inflation are managing to do okay in this environment. And then the people that cannot afford the inflation are suffering. And so this is all part of the new, I suppose, post the tariff era that we're living in now. This, what they're calling, is the end of the rules-based economic trade order. And, you know, this is something that needs to be considered in the round, rather than just picking, you know, one part or two parts or this country or that country. It has to be holistic and it has to be global in nature.
Enjoying my conversation with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He is the Loman Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University and senior historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. His work focuses on international relations, presidential history, and the American political culture. And he joins us periodically on Main Street. Canada, we have come to understand, plans to retaliate dollar for dollar. And then the United States, it'll be its turn, perhaps. Once both countries impose tariffs, how difficult is it going to be for either side to taco it back, if you will, or to step back?
Well, escalation means that the pain is going to increase in both economies. I think, you can look at, let's just take one group, for example, the distillers in the United States, those people who make, or the, you know, the beverage industry. So wine, bourbon, those sort of products that are quintessentially American, right? Like Napa Valley Reds and Jim Beam. Jim Beam, for the first time in its history, shut down production for almost the guts of a year. I mean, that's unheard of, but that means that they're selling so much less bourbon, not just to Canada, which it's not, you know, the biggest, you know, buyer of bourbon, but the rest of the world. I mean, this is going to have big implications for businesses, for employment. And then, you know, on the Canadian side as well, if they put retaliatory tariffs on, their industries will suffer unquestionably. And so, you know, while we're looking at Carney's approval rating being through the roof right now, in 2 years' time, if this trade war is still going on, I guarantee you Mark Carney is not getting 75% approval ratings. But the bigger thing that we have to look at is November of this year. Will the American public get behind Donald Trump's tariffs, or are they going to vote for Democrats and flip the House and the Senate?
Yeah, interesting that you mentioned 2 years, because to create new manufacturing, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens over the long term. And the question becomes, what political ramifications is that going to have in the midterms? Because things won't change a lot between now and November. One way really or the other. We're not going to notice stagflation or severe inflation or anything between now and then. Yet, it's the long game. And can his political strength survive the long game? I'm speaking, you mentioned the Canadian president probably can't, but what about the American president?
I don't think any politician can, democratically elected president or prime minister, can withstand the long game. The Chinese premier can, because they have no exit. You know, there's no democratic consensus that's going to oust them from power. But in a democracy, 4 years or 5 years, whatever the term might be, for an elected head of state, a business is looking, you know, for the next 100 years. I mean, NVIDIA's profits on microchips are looking 30, 40, 50 years into the future. You know, that'll be several administrations down the road. And as you say about manufacturing, the tariffs, the 15% tariffs that Donald Trump put on pharmaceuticals, for example, out of the EU, that hasn't changed the manufacturing. It's a temporary blip on the balance sheets of these companies. But like Eli Lilly and Pfizer are not going to leave Europe and start manufacturing in the USA tomorrow. They'll wait the 2 years and find out if Trump is still there, which he won't be, right, because he's term limited. But if the policy is still there, and then they'll make a decision about manufacturing. So the waiting game, I mean, businesses have that privilege. Politicians in democratic countries do not.
Take us back to look at this in the long-term perspective, Michael. Has there been an administration or a president that has exercised this sort of will towards Canada in our history?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. This is not a first. I mean, so several American presidents in the 19th century created high tariffs in order to protect national industries. Perhaps the most famous and the one that we talk about a lot is William McKinley, because Trump often talks about McKinley as his model. So McKinley's tariffs in 1890 raise, you know, on everything, all sorts of goods that are imported, and then they want to bring in reciprocal tariffs for countries that are cooperating with the United States on those tariffs. However, it doesn't work, because you have Democrats that are advocating for free trade. So the party before McKinley, the president before McKinley, was Grover Cleveland. He reduced the tariffs. Before that, Benjamin Harrison increased them. Before that, Cleveland reduced them. So there's this back and forth. And we'll see this nowadays, too. I mean, the Democrats, if they get into power, they're likely to reduce the tariffs in order to try and curry favor with countries that have been disaffected by Trump. So that's the likely trajectory. And I might add, because Donald Trump has treated tariffs as if it's an executive power, that's the will of the president, it means that the next president, if that president comes from a different party, can do exactly the same thing. It's a really dangerous precedent, and it's why Congress has always been tasked with dealing with tariffs in the past. So that is new, and that is exclusively happening now. In the past, though, the back and forth, that had happened all the time.
Tariffs have ended up in courts, even in the Trump administration. Do you see this current salvo against Canada also winding up in courts, or is the president using a different part of American law where he might be immune from pressure of the courts to have to change course?
Yeah, that's a good question, but it's one that probably doesn't have an easy answer because A, the president has introduced these tariffs and then the courts have to decide whether they're legal or not. But that process can take, as we saw last time around, about 18 months, maybe longer. And they have to get the right cases. Those lawsuits have to be filed. The amicus briefs need to come out. I mean, that is by that time, 18 months time, we will know if the Senate and the House are Republican or Democrat. We might even in 18 months know who's running for president in 2028, right? So there's a lot that will change in the next 18 months. And also a lot can change with the economic situation. So if things deteriorate at home and the president needs to reduce prices on goods in the United States, then that means that those tariffs could come off very quickly.
North Dakota, as we've mentioned, will be affected directly by Canadian tariffs. Other states in the country will be as well. Do you think that we will see more congressional pushback to this current round than we've seen before?
I mean, when you look at the states that are currently the swing states for the Senate, for example, right?
Michigan.
Michigan, which of course the bridge between Detroit and Canada is Kingston is always talked about as the thoroughfare of trans-American trade. Alaska, where you've got a really close race, first time a Democrat in probably 10 years is in the run. And then Maine, where you've got a very close race between Susan Collins and Jackson, the new Democratic candidate. Those are three states with borders with Canada. And I think they are going to be using this as a cudgel to beat Trump with. The Democrats will. I think the Republicans are already starting to distance themselves a little bit from this trade policy. I mean, how that plays out in Congress, I'd really be interested to see because, of course, Congress does have the power to push back on these trade policies. They can create a tariff policy of their own, and if it passes with enough of a majority, it can override even the president. So I don't think we're there yet, but I do think that states like, Susan Collins and the likes of Lisa Murkowski, they might be voting against Trump on trade policies in the coming months.
Let's turn the page, Michael, to the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. You're the senior historian there. Of course, it opened amongst great fanfare on July 4th in Medora. And after years of planning, has it went like you thought it would?
I mean, yes and no. I think, like with everything that you've spent, I spent 5.5 years, almost 6 years working on this project and through various different iterations. I know what made it, what didn't make the cut. And part of me loves that. I'll tell you, when I finished the tour, when I was there in June, when all the exhibits were pretty much 100% erected and I went through the whole thing, I got really emotional at the end, especially because the ending of the tour it is emotive. I mean, you're left with TR's legacy and it's such a powerful moment. On that front, I think that the library delivered exactly what it said it would. And also, by the way, on time, which is that's a remarkable feat that opened on July 4th.
Very important deadline, and it met it. Yes, it did.
And it met it. And all kudos to the team, particularly Ed O'Keefe, who did a wonderful job of shepherding that. Sadly, Ed O'Keefe is moving on to another position at Channel 13 in New York. I'm so grateful for his leadership and for making that happen because that was no small feat in itself.
I'm sure you've been monitoring public response much more closely than just general numbers who have been tracking through the museum. Has anything been brought to you about the way visitors have experienced the library that surprised you?
I mean, I think what I'm most surprised is just how much everyone comes to the museum from their own perspective. So I did some media for Hawaiian television a couple of weeks ago. Naka Nathaniel, who's a great reporter out in Hawaii, visited the presidential library. He also visited Obama's presidential library. And when he talked to AITR, the first thing he asked TR about was Queen Liliuokalani, who, of course, was the deposed queen of the Kingdom of Hawaii. And TR gave a very political TR type response to what was a difficult question about foreign policy. I think everyone comes to the library, asking and thinking about their state, their region, their political viewpoint, their sort of what attracts them to TR. And that's a great thing. I mean, I think what you get out of it is a broader context of the history, a better understanding of who the man was and why he's important for the American experience.
What work is there left to do for you at the library?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the National Endowment for Humanities has just awarded a grant of $750,000 to enhance the exhibit space with artifacts and objects that are you know, basically going to make the narrative galleries within the museum pop. So I think that's going to be the next big project. There is also a temporary exhibit that's opening in October. The photographer, David Kennerly, he's a presidential photographer, and that exhibit's going to be really remarkable with all the photos that he's taken over the years from, I think, Gerald Ford all the way up to George W. Bush. So he's a really important figure as well. And there's more. There's a ton more to come. I mean, watch this space. It's going to be an important venue for decades, a century to come in North Dakota.
Now that the fanfare of the grand opening is behind us, what's your best invitation for someone who has kind of waited? Now, maybe this fall might want to go to visit the library. What would you tell them?
Well, I would say there's a major event in October that I would invite everyone to. It's a paid event, so you'd have to shell out for it, but I think it's completely worth it. And that's TeddyCon. It's the first Theodore Roosevelt convention ever. It's a partnership between the Presidential Library, the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State University, and the Theodore Roosevelt Association out of New York. And we're all coming together to put together a really remarkable program of events. Karl Rove will be speaking, John Avalon, a famous CNN broadcaster, and so many other authors, entertainers will be there for a weekend from October 9th to October 11th. And those sort of events are going to become fairly regular. So I think watch out. I mean, this allows Western North Dakota to have, a remarkable venue to bring these sort of events together.
Has the tourist response been real positive from your perspective, other than just normal summer traffic in Medora?
So I think it's outpaced the projections. Currently, I think we're at around 70,000 visitors. I think 70,000 was an estimate for February or March time. So in terms of the numbers, yes. I mean, I think in terms of the public's reaction to the exhibits, the architecture, the broader kind of landscape, that's also been really positive. So we've seen amazing reviews in Architectural Digest and other places as well. So yeah, no, it's turned out even better than I think everyone's expectations.
Michael Patrick Cullinane is the Loman Walton Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University and Senior Historian for the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora. We've been discussing the escalating tariff dispute between the United States and Canada, its implications for North Dakota and the country, and also reflecting on the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. Michael, as always, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Craig.
Still to come on this Tuesday's Main Street in his weekly Plainspoke essay, historian Dr. Tom Ezern profiles Lawrence R. Waldron, a pioneering agricultural scientist whose plant breeding helped North Dakota farmers battle wheat rust and whose intellectual curiosity made him a true scholar of the land grant tradition. That's ahead, right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Lawrence R. Waldron arrived in North Dakota as a student and became one of the state's most influential agricultural scientists. He advised West River homesteaders, championed alfalfa, and developed improved wheat varieties in a continuing battle against crop-destroying rust. Historian Dr. Tom Ezern reflects on Waldron's scientific achievements and the wide-ranging curiosity that defined him as a scholar in this week's Plainsfolk.
He was the research scientist who served as father confessor to the homesteaders of the West River during the Second Dakota Boom, laying out the principles of dry farming, exhorting new arrivals to plant trees, and putting grim alfalfa into their hands to sustain livestock enterprises and complement field agriculture. Lawrence R. Waldron, the founding superintendent of the Dickinson Substation for Agricultural Research in 1905, was the author of that forgotten but valuable handbook, Hints for Homesteaders, and that manifesto of alfalfa fever in North Dakota, a bulletin just titled Alfalfa. Well, these works came from Waldron's time in Dickinson. A Michigan boy, he had come first to Fargo to attend the school where his elder brother had a teaching appointment, North Dakota Agricultural College. He became a protege of Henry Luke Bolley, the most prominent agricultural scientist in the first generation of college faculty, and, oh, incidentally, the founder of the Bison football team, on which he played as a faculty member. Bolley's protege, Waldron, was, I think, more intellectually inclined than the mentor. I say this from having worked through the Waldron papers held by the Institute for Regional Studies at NDSU. Following his sojourn at Dickinson, Waldron went east to Cornell for a Ph.D., while also taking up duties at the Fargo station as plant breeder in charge of the wheat program. Waldron ushered plant breeding here out of its pioneer stage, which consisted mainly of selection, just picking the best specimens of a crop variety and refining them, and into the world of 20th century plant breeding, wherein improvements were induced by bringing together diverse strains with complementary virtues. It was Waldron's lot to deal with the great wheat rust epidemics of the 20th century, a crisis of post-frontier agriculture on the northern plains, beginning with the disastrous year of 1916. He bred successive new varieties that both exhibited rust resistance and also increased yield. But the problem was, as wheat crop varieties improved, the fungi in the field morphed and evolved and continually recurred. This botanical dance was still going on when Waldron died in 1954. And so, I read his obituaries, which have the sense of unfinished business, but on the other hand, are edifying. One of the books I currently have in progress has to do with what I consider the greatest generation on the Great Plains. Not the original pioneers, they get all the credit, but rather the next generation, that one that came to grips with the land and realized the Great Plains as a region in American life. Lawrence Waldron spoke for, worked for, and represented that generation. So I quote now from one of his obituaries. During his college years at NDAC, Dr. Waldron labored in the experimental fields for 12 and a half cents an hour, declaring later it was during this period that he was inspired with the science of plant breeding. While on campus, he became known as the greatest user at the library, and it was believed he had read more books than anyone on the faculty. When reading in his own field, he filled books with penciled notations, particularly when he found a doubtful statement or errors. His reading covered a whole field, including a study of evolution, of the Middle Ages, the Inquisition, sorcery, witchcraft. He was one of the college's earliest plant collectors, and the herbarium includes many specimens he gathered in his early days in the state. He traveled all over North Dakota and displayed a wide range of interests. This sounds to me like the definition of a scholar in Democracy's College.
Historian Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. His essay, The Scholar in Democracy's College, is part of his Plains Folk series.
Right now in North Dakota, one in four adults is caring for someone they love. AARP offers a family caregiving guide with information, planning tools, and North Dakota resources for family caregivers. The guide is available at no cost at aarp.org/ndcarekit. Support for this announcement comes from AARP.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Rising food prices are forcing millions of older Americans on fixed incomes to make difficult choices. Nicole Grunmeier reports for Harvest Public Media and the Midwest Newsroom.
Once a month, the people who live at this low-income retirement community in Storm Lake, Iowa, gather to create their own food pantry. The donations come from the Food Bank of Iowa.
How many are the peppers?
Today, fresh pineapples, potatoes, and bell peppers pile up on tables. The residents can go through and take the items they need. Linda Rufus, who is 67, relies on this pop-up pantry.
Well, I'm thinking about how I'm going to rob Peter to pay Paul because food prices are extremely high and I have to really weigh out what's more important or how I can get the most out of a meal.
Rufus says she's stretching every dollar and trying to find cheaper, filling food items. While she loves beef, she's now buying ground turkey. Her neighbor, Tony Keller, is also shopping at the pop-up pantry today. The 65-year-old spent years outside the workforce as a caregiver, which reduced her retirement benefits.
I get a whopping $304 a month because I had a sick child, so most of my time was spent with her.
That Social Security payment isn't nearly enough to cover Keller's living expenses, including food. She relies on SNAP federal food assistance and programs like this pop-up pantry. She recently completed treatment for breast cancer and tries to prioritize eating fresh fruits and vegetables.
After having cancer, you're eating a little differently, which costs more money to do.
High food prices are pushing older adults to make difficult budget decisions affecting their health. Nationwide, food prices were 3% higher this June compared to the same time last year, according to federal data. Jessica Johnson is a senior strategist at the National Council on Aging.
So much of the conversation around SNAP and food insecurity really has been around children and families, and older adults really are often a forgotten population.
More than 7 million Americans aged 16 up experienced food insecurity in 2023, according to the National Council on Aging. That's approximately 1 in 11 older Americans. Gina Platanino is the director of policy and advocacy at the Food Research and Action Center. She says Social Security benefits don't protect older adults from hunger.
Your rent didn't decrease because you turned 60. Your utilities didn't decrease because you turned 60. Neither did fuel and neither did food.
Nearly half of older adults who carry credit card debt are using their cards to buy food, according to the AARP. In the Kansas City region, Metro Lutheran Ministry operates three food pantries. Community Assistance Manager Kimberly Bernard says they're seeing consistently high demand from older residents.
We see a lot of people that are in that population of seniors that they really rely heavily on the food pantries because it's a challenge for them to be able to budget the amount that they receive monthly.
Back in Iowa, Linda Rufus says she and her fellow residents at the Storm Lake Senior Housing are grateful for the pop-up pantry.
Because if it were not for the food banks, you know, supplying us with food, you know, we would be in a lot worse condition than we are.
But for now, experts say seniors on fixed incomes will likely continue to feel the squeeze of high food costs.
That report came from Nicole Grunmeier of Harvest Public Media and the Midwest Newsroom. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. The Indigenous perspective on the Colorado River is often overlooked. Jimmy Romo, an Indigenous Affairs reporter for KNPR in Las Vegas, has been covering what is at stake for tribes as water levels continue to decline. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Romo about his reporting.
So you were recently on the Fort Mojave Reservation and saw their irrigation pumps. Can you describe what that was all like?
So for the Fort Mojave Reservation, it's located within three states, Arizona, California, and Nevada. And it's kind of like a checkerboard, farmlands scattered around. And Chairman Timothy Williams drove me around in his truck to see that farmland, that checkerboard, that and how that agriculture really, you know, pays for those services on the tribe. And he showed us the pump on this really humid and hot day. But the pumps are housed in these large metal gates just along the river on that Arizona side. and it's like right along this rock line that the chairman had pointed out. He's like, if it goes any lower, there's just no more water that can be pumped. And just on the other side is the California side, where the chairman pointed out that there are these million-dollar homes while the tribe is trying to maintain itself with these super low water levels. And there's a lot of recreation that goes on the river, boats and jet skis.
And your story talked about the deep connection that the Fort Mojave people have with the river. Can you tell us a little bit about what you heard about that?
Absolutely. The Fort Mojave are the Pipa Makav, people who live by the river. They've been protecting the river since the start of time. And Colleen Neolich Garcia, a tribal member and now recently titled an elder, shared with me this clip.
And at that time, years ago, the Colorado River was immense. It was large. It just flowed in the valley all the way from up north, all the way down south. And with that water, it gave us life.
She also shared that it's not just, you know, cultural and a big economic driver. It's also, you know, when they were growing up, that was where to go, where to hang out. They'd swim across the river back and forth. But now with how the river looks now, they just can't do that. The kids aren't doing that anymore.
And there's a lot of concern across the West about the conditions on the river. What are you hearing from Indigenous folks about how they are feeling?
They're very concerned. You know, I can't speak for all 30 tribes that are along the river, but from the perspective of Fort Mojave, the levels are really low. When I was out there, you know, that rock line was only a few feet from, you know, not being able to pump water to their agriculture irrigators, right? So if they're not able to pump water for agriculture, there is no agriculture for them. And it's a different perspective for all 30 tribes. But when I spoke to Jay Weiner, he's a water attorney for the Kitsan Indian tribe, who's also along the river, you know, when he saw that new resolution, the new rulings for the river, it was really disappointing. And it's also the factor that, you know, we have these negotiations to how to conserve the river, but tribes aren't a part of that conversation, even though they hold about a third of that water.
And there's a lot of coverage of the Colorado River out there. What do you think is often missed or misunderstood about tribes and their relationship with the river?
One of the biggest misconceptions is that tribes do have water rights. So I think that's a big thing that we're missing sometimes in the conversation about the Colorado River, is that tribes have water rights, and all 30 tribes amount to about a third of that water. But still, tribes are not at the negotiating table for these conservation efforts.
And you've also reported on other tribes and how they are using their water allocations and responding to the drought. Can you tell us more about what you've learned?
What I've learned is that tribes are very innovative with how they're using their water, right? An example is the Fort Mojave tribe uses it for agriculture. And even like the Las Vegas Paiute tribe, they have the Snow Mountain Reservation outside of Las Vegas, where they have 3 golf courses. They also have a cannabis growing facility, and they also have housing, right? So it's been very interesting to see how tribes are wanting to use that water and just how they're going to use it for their people. So even though they're not at the negotiating tables, like a state is, they're still finding ways to react to what comes down on them and make the best out of that situation.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Is it finally time for Glen Canyon Dam to go? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Amid a mega drought and aridification in the Southwest, the federal government has released its operating plan to manage 2 large dams on the Colorado River, and it's being criticized for propping up one of them, mainly by sacrificing farmers.
4 years ago, the Glen Canyon Institute wrote that the glory years of Glen Canyon Dam, which generates electricity for about 5 million people, may be coming to an end. Instead of addressing that problem head-on, Trump administration guidelines are requiring that the lower basin states of Arizona, Nevada, and California dramatically reduce their consumption for the next 2 years by more than 1 million acre feet. annually.
Arizona will suffer the largest cut of 31% of its supplies from the river, with the Phoenix and Tucson areas hardest hit. The upper basin states of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico won't be forced to cut their use for now.
Some critics say the Bureau's plan delays the inevitable bypass of Glen Canyon Dam, which forms Lake Powell. Dan Beard, a former Bureau of Reclamation commissioner, told E&E News in 2023 that the reservoir is not essential to the operation of the river system.
As the water levels drop at Lake Powell, the dam has been making less energy. If the reservoir were full, it could generate 1,320 megawatts. But now, with the reservoir at record low levels, the Bureau says the complex has generated less than half that. Organizations that have bought power generated by the dam have already been looking for alternative sources.
Keeping Glen Canyon Dam while it generates less power has consequences. Gary Wachner with the organization Save the Colorado told H2O Radio that water stored in Lake Powell is lost to evaporation and seepage into the sandstone.
The Glen Canyon Institute estimated that the reservoir loses about 860,000 acre-feet a year, more than the amount used by the city of Los Angeles annually. They add that the water from the upper basin states to fill Lake Powell could have been used by farmers upstream, but will end up in the atmosphere or in the ground.
The Bureau's guidelines issued last week said they're not to be construed as a precedent for future operations, but Wachner disagrees, saying it locks in this response to the crisis even as climate science shows the region is getting drier.
How you roll in California could soon change. Last week, the state became the first in the country to mandate efficiency standards for replacement tires.
Tires that come on new cars typically give drivers better mileage because they have low rolling resistance. Rolling resistance is a measure of how much a tire flattens and rebounds as it travels along the ground. The more it squishes, the more energy it takes, whether from gas or from a battery, to keep the wheels turning.
When consumers replace tires, they are often less efficient, resulting in lower mileage and range. By 2033, California's Replacement Tire Efficiency Program will require that they match the efficiency of new car tires.
The California Energy Commission says the standard will save nearly $1 billion in gasoline and electricity costs per year and reduce carbon dioxide emissions by the equivalent of eliminating 400,000 gas cars from California's roads.
The agency said the expense for consumers will be low, up to $6.50 per tire, which would be offset by lower fuel consumption. However, some tire manufacturers and industry groups disagree, saying the increased costs would exceed projected savings. But Bridgestone and Michelin, who were involved in the five-year rulemaking process, embraced the new program.
And finally, in the oceans, there are predators and there are prey. For critters who are low on the food chain, they've learned behaviors to avoid becoming someone's dinner, often by hiding or changing location.
The process is known as the ecology of fear, where the mere presence of a predator changes behavior. But what can mussels, which are literally stuck in place, do?
Naturally, they would clam up, according to researchers at Aarhus University. The team found that when blue mussels detected parasitic flatworms nearby, they slowed their filtration of seawater. And when things got really scary with more than one parasite in the vicinity, they closed their shells completely.
Blue mussels feed by filtering microscopic algae from seawater, and a single mussel can filter up to 100 liters a day, affecting water clarity and nutrient cycling. Their beds also provide habitats for small animals, fish, and plants.
The mussels have a well-developed sensory system capable of detecting chemicals in water that could mean a threat is nearby. But that leaves the bivalves with a conundrum. Stop eating or risk ingesting something deadly.
The research suggests they will clam up. But if a whole bed shuts down, it could affect the health of an entire ecosystem.
The team says that because ocean parasites tend to prefer warmer water and mussels get scared when they're around, their reaction could become more common with climate change if flatworms mussel in.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Bird Note. Former Washington Governor Jay Inslee has been around birds his entire life, but he says it wasn't until his early 30s that a bird really caught his attention.
We'd moved from Western Washington, you know, a wet kind of urban environment, to Eastern Washington, a dry sagebrush, apple trees environment. And we heard this meadowlark sitting right on top of this little unused telephone pole outside of our farmhouse that we had.
This was a Western meadowlark, a robin-sized bird with a vibrant yellow breast and a spectacular song.
And it is just melodic. That's the word I would use. I'm not a musician. I know virtually nothing about music. But I think that if Mendelssohn and Brahms and Brandy Carlile got together to design a bird song, that's what they would write. Every year, we knew it was spring when that bird or its subsequent generations came, I swear, to the same telephone pole and just ripped out this incredible song that we could hear, you know, 150 yards away.
Over time, Inslee grew to love the meadowlark's song, not only for its melody, but for how it connected him to the natural world.
I would describe it as summoning us from winter to spring. So it's like it announces the change of the seasons.
Is there a bird that inspired you to love nature? Tell us about it at birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 25th. In August of 1930, men who had fought for the Union during the Civil War and were able to make the trip to Cincinnati were at a convention for the Boys in Blue, who marched home with a Union victory in 65. On this date in 1930, Smith Stimmel of Fargo was a candidate to be elected as the new commander-in-chief at the convention. In the end, he did not win this honor. However, he did help in a different role. When a play was presented at the convention showing Abraham Lincoln during the war, the actor playing the president was apparently a striking likeness, so much so that one of the old soldiers fainted. The veteran noted, "I never in my life saw anyone look so much like Lincoln." The man was carried out, and Smith Stimmel was one of the first to help him. Stimmel had a special connection to Lincoln. After joining the military at age 20 during the Civil War, he was appointed to the Union Light Guard and assigned to the White House. From December of 1863 until April 14, 1865, he was a bodyguard for the president. Following Lincoln's assassination, Stimmel returned home to Ohio, attended Wesleyan University, and became a lawyer. He moved to Fargo in 1882. In 1888, Stimmel was elected president of the Territorial Council. He practiced law on the state until 1921. His trip back to Cincinnati for the Boys in Blue convention was memorable. The men were able to visit Ulysses S. Grant's gravesite and hear Grant's grandson speak. The Bismarck Tribune also detailed a welcoming event, writing, "The gray-haired, faltering veterans again will hear the strains of martial music and receive the praise of public officials." Smith had become a Lincoln expert of sorts, and later in life would speak and write about him. He was the last surviving member of Lincoln's personal bodyguard attachment when he passed away at the age of 92 in Fargo in 1935. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well,
Wile E. Coyote can't catch the Roadrunner no matter how hard he tries, so he lawyers up.
You really feel for this character who has historically been the bad guy. He's basically trying to murder this bird and eat it.
Why a classic Looney Tunes character goes to court in a new film.
Meep, meep.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, 20 years of funk. Fargo Moorhead's Post-Traumatic Funk Syndrome celebrates two decades of music, memorable performances, and keeping us on our feet. They're having a special event this Friday at the TAC Event Center in Dilworth. Plus, Rhombus Guys marks 15 years in downtown Fargo. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.